I'll say.
Please.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Do you get lost, Connection listeners, in the lingo of the management gurus between your competitive advantage, say, and your core competencies, between the total quality management fad and the re-engineering cycle? Some of the slogans in these best-selling business manuals can sound obscure, like our guest Peter Senge's fifth discipline. Who can name the first five? Or the first four? Some other slogans can sound over-obvious, like the same Peter Senge's idea that in a suddenly global and electronic economy, any organization that survives is going to be a community of nonstop learning and adaptation to change. But the Peter Senge's of this world don't make the big bucks for nothing. They are the weathermen in a continuous storm. They're the psychiatrists and the teachers to the big companies, and they're some of the best inside reporters on what's going on in the world. Peter Senge is a change agent who has found, oddly enough, that when the going gets tough, a lot of the tough guys don't change. Inertia rules more companies than change does, he says. But the dance of change, in the title of his new book, is still the key. Connection listeners, the question that made Peter Senge famous was, does your organization have a learning disability? Peter Senge speaks now about what he has learned about learning. Connection listeners, speak for yourselves. What have you learned about learning? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. And does your organization have a learning disability? 1-800-423-TALK with our guest, Peter Senge. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you.
We've been looking forward to this for a long time. I am fascinated but that a change guy like you says that the bigger force out there in the modern management world is inertia. What are people fighting?
Well, they're fighting to preserve things they care about. And it's easy to say that people all resist change. I think it's an almost meaningless statement. All change unfolds as an interplay between things that are being conserved and things that are changing. Nature is full of change, but nature also conserves. Oftentimes, this business about people resisting change is really the statement of one person or one point of view angry that other people won't go along with their point of view or their believed need that something has to happen. You know, at one level, it comes down to something very simple, Chris. You know, if someone's trying to change you, what's your immediate reaction?
What's wrong with me?
Exactly. I mean, I don't know anybody. I've never met anybody who said, oh, yes, I love it when people come up and try to change me. It's a little bit paradoxical in this sense.
People love situations, though, in which a month down the road, 2 years down the road, they realize they're different folk.
Exactly. That was the paradox I was just about to point out to. At one level, we seek novelty. We are naturally curious. We're naturally experimental. If something is just perfect, we'll go and try something else. At another level, when someone comes along and tries to change us, our immediate instincts, emotional and then intellectual as well, are, no, not me. Well, who are you to tell me what I should be doing? So we both seek and resist change.
Justice Holmes said life is an experiment. How do you, or do you try to promote that notion in organizations?
Yeah, very much so. I think a lot of the difficulties people experience with change really come down to something very simple. It really, at some level, below the surface, somebody is trying to change somebody else, rather than in some sense unleashing the intrinsic curiosity and experimentalism which would lead people to seek change themselves. I'm not saying that, you know, just it's a complete free-for-all, but I am saying that when we're in the situation of we're trying to change someone else, why are we surprised that they're not waving a flag saying, whoopee, thanks a lot for coming down and changing me here?
What does learning have to do with it?
Well, I think that's a way to begin to tap that intrinsic orientation. I believe that we all are born as learning-orientated beings. It is in us. Nobody, in sense, creates an incentive system for an eight-month-old to learn to walk. It seems to be in the person. No one creates an incentive system to learn to talk. No one creates an incentive system for you as a young child to learn how your family works and learn what it takes to get what you want in that setting. Learning is just part of what it means to be alive. So one interesting way to, you might say, make an end run around all this nonsense of change and resistance to change is to kind of come at it from the other end and say, well, what is it that's keeping us from actualizing and living out our natural orientation to learn? And by the way, there's absolutely no evidence that that orientation dissipates as we grow older. Many people have some of their most profound learnings and developments in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. Stradivarius made his greatest violins when he was in his 90s. And there's tons of examples like that. So there's absolutely no evidence that this drive to learn is limited to children.
And Susan Sontag's learning to play the piano in her late 60s. I mean, that's another connection, but it's an important model in my head. There's a wonderful passage in your book describing the most important revolution in the making of our world as the Industrial Revolution in the last, say, 250 years, in which was entirely unled, unregulated, unpolitical. I want you to apply that point to the world we live in today. We all know intuitively that we're in a multiple, connected, enormous revolution in everything. How do you begin to describe it, and how do we think about swimming in it?
Right. Well, I think it's one of the most challenging kind of questions. Your metaphor, I mean, it's very hard to see the water you're swimming in. What's the old joke? You know, it's hard to know what fish talk about, but you can be sure it's not water. And I think that's very much the situation we're in. I'm not a big fan of the term the information revolution. I think it's very easy for us to describe these extraordinary changes we're in the midst of in terms of some obvious technology. We're a very technologically oriented society, so we tend to look at the technology and say, well, that's the change. I doubt that 50 years from now, this period of time will be seen as being solely about information technology. The Industrial Revolution clearly had a lot of technology elements to it, but it also had a totally different way of organizing social activities. And eventually, and probably most importantly, a deep set of metaphors and images that kind of got into the head of everyone so deeply that I think we, even today, are still guided by those images and metaphors. They organized our society. I think the dominant metaphor, actually, it's interesting, when you ask people, well, what's the dominant metaphor of the Industrial Age? Most people usually say the assembly line, which is probably right in a way, but it's a little bit more at the concrete or tangible level. I would be more inclined to say the dominant metaphor is actually the machine. Hence our obsession today with technology. Everything new, everything exciting, everything in the paper that's, wow, look at that, is a new technology. But I don't think it's the metaphor for the future.
Put us back into the revolution we're in. What are its metaphors, and how do we, again, I don't want to say master it, write it, understand it, but do whatever we do with it.
In the Industrial Age?
No, in the global electronic millennium.
Okay.
The web age.
Well, I have
genome age. Sorry.
The genome age, right. Well, that might be a bit of a clue, too. Obviously, we all come at this in inherently subjective way. So I speak not as an expert, but as another person kind of walking around and scratching my heads like all of us. I tend to think about it from the standpoint of what are some of the deepest issues and problems in the world. Problems like the fact that our whole model of growth is by its nature not sustainable. You know, depending on who you talk to, 94 to 99% of everything we take out of the earth to produce a product ends up as waste. That's not sustainable. We run the most inefficient system the humankind has ever seen from the standpoint of natural resources. I look at it from the standpoint of the quality of our lives. I actually don't think people are very happy. Now, that's a big statement, and maybe some people would contest it, but it seems to me that I remember many years ago, our oldest son, who was part of the computer age. I mean, he had his first Macintosh when he was 4. So the computer is a everyday artifact of his life. He has no computer phobia. I remember when he first started thinking about, well, does he want to be on the Internet, and does he want to do email? And his initial reaction, this was about the age of 12 or 13, he said, I don't really think, not yet. It's not really that important to me. Now, it seems to me This is all supposed to be able to make life easier. It seems to make people more busy and more hectic and more frantic. Is that really what I want? I think a lot of what we drift into is not guided by the question, what do we want? It's guided by a sense of necessity. This is coming. I better react. I don't necessarily think that's the way we're designed to live. So I think the deeper questions are really about how are we living and how do we want to live?
And then what do we do about it? The dance of change, as I read it, is addressed especially to companies, organizations, nonprofits, government too, I suppose.
I would add schools to that.
Yep. Radio programs. What are your inspirational examples here, if not models?
Well, I think for me, probably the inspirational examples from my firsthand experience are just the experience of being part of teams in all kinds of settings, of going back to sports long time ago, but including all kinds of different work settings where there's really magic in the air. I think most all of us have had that experience in some setting or other. Could have been a theater troupe, could have been a rock band we got together when we were teenagers. It could have been a work setting, could have been a sports team. But I think many of us have had this experience that something extraordinary can happen when a group of people actually begin to function as a kind of whole. And I think a lot of my inspiration has come from that experience again and again and again, and coming to realize that it's actually quite a universal experience. It's not limited by space and setting.
How do you implant it in, we always come back to Dilbert's cubicle.
Well, if we're talking about how do you begin to help any group of people working together to move in this direction, it does help to start the way we just did, to kind of reflect on, well, what is it that I really care about? And what is it that kind of is a guiding, you might say, formative experience? There's an old saw in the creative arts, it's very hard to create what you can't imagine. You know, in some sense, we must have some concrete or real experience of what it is we're trying to bring into being. It doesn't mean it'll look the way we imagine it. It'll always look different. But that imagination is so powerful to our creative process. So I always think it helps a lot to start with, you know, like, well, so when have I been part of a group of people who work together in an extraordinary way, regardless of the setting? And then I believe very strongly that there really are practices, there are tools, there are methods, there are things you have to do. If you're inspired to be a musician, that's great, but you need disciplines. You know, discipline is the body of method and practice that helps us develop that which was potentially within us. There's a lot of people with great musical talent running around who never become musicians because they don't develop the self-discipline. So I do believe you gravitate towards asking, well, so what are some of the things we can actually start to do on a day-by-day basis? For example, when we have a meeting, what goes wrong in that meeting? Well, you know, I notice that nobody actually listens to anybody. Great. So what's the discipline of listening like for us? What would it mean to start to practice a discipline of listening? How would that start to play out on a moment-by-moment basis for me and for us? You always look for something that's real, concrete, day-to-day, in our everyday experience, and say, if we started to pay attention more closely to that, how might it enable us to work together differently? People can always find those.
They can, and oftentimes, you know, if we said the problem of this meeting is that nobody is listening, well, first I suppose it would be met with denial. I was listening, I wasn't really doing the crossword puzzle, but then it would be, gosh, that's common sense. I'm not going to pay you for that advice, that we ought to listen in these meetings. How does this wisdom differ from common sense?
Yeah, can we stop on that? Because I think that what you did right there, and I think it's probably very helpful because a lot of people are probably doing it, is evoked a kind of interpretive frame around what I was saying. I don't think anybody should necessarily pay for any of this. I mean, this is kind of common knowledge. The real question is,
you don't tell your accountant doesn't tell you that, I'm sure.
I haven't done any consulting in 15 years.
Really?
No, I don't do any consulting. No, the Society for Organization Learning is a global network community of people who work together to try to build practical know-how and do this. I believe very strongly that if we don't collaborate, nothing can change anyhow. So working with individual companies is not very high leverage, in my opinion. Now, I'm not saying that a lot of people don't do good work as consultants. consultants. But I think that it can really create a bit of a distorted image. Well, what do you have for me? See, that's our marketplace mindset. That, by the way, is a very big part of the industrial age. You know, the markets, that we only do something when there's something in it for us, and then it's always an economic transaction. But in fact, that never explains communities. Communities are bound together by what people can contribute, not what they can get. And, you know, it's important what you get. But you don't keep returning to a community or a setting where you work voluntarily except by the feeling you have that you're actually making a difference, you're making a contribution. So I believe that the logic of communities is pretty important for this kind of work.
It sounds deeply true to me. And it sounds like, oddly enough, the way the connection works, too. I mean,
sure,
there's a community out there eager to engage you, a completely untransactional, un-cash community of enthusiasm, of learning, of adaptation, of discovery. And our phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. I read your book, I have to say, Peter Senge, and I always think, you know, this, it sounds like common sense, but it's also the way only one thing I know I've ever worked with works, and that's this radio program. And it's, I mean, both the inner organization and the outer energy of it, too. Let's see what happens. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection with the business guru who doesn't consult, but he writes and keeps thinking about this world, Peter Senge. Brian is on the line.
Yes, how are you today?
Good, Brian.
Good. I'm a huge fan of Peter's. I get his books as soon as they come out. I'm a strong believer in it.
Now, Brian, what just tell me what you get out of them.
Well, I think there's a lot of things. I think that you can't take anybody someplace, as Peter would say, without having a vision, and more importantly, without motivating them to why this is good for them. Because if we look at what drives organizational change, there's certain things that are known, and it's fear of loss, it's what you're doing is too painful, it's what's in it for me. And it's a matter of figuring out what those matrices are based upon personalities, people's beliefs, that become the motivations for either driving change or taking down the barriers of change.
Do we give him a passing grade, Peter Senge, and let him ask his question?
Do you have a question you wanted to ask, Brian?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think one of the things that often stops change is the factor that the risk for reward systems today don't support change. And the example I'd like to give of that in a positive way is that if I were the chairman of a public company or if I were the president of a public company, that I'm serving so many people that have different agendas of what's good or what's important that affect either my job, my compensation. So whether I'm serving the shareholders, the ability to make profit, the employees that are what really is making me successful, that how do I find a better balance of that organizationally?
Well, if we look at it from the standpoint of someone in a top management position, maybe the simplest way to think about it is if you were a CEO of an enterprise. You know, it's a very complicated world you're in today. And I agree completely that the cross currents pulling you in different directions are immense. It's very easy in that kind of setting, and it's very human, to kind of grab at one thing and say, well, this is it. And increasingly, probably, a lot of CEOs have grabbed at shareholder value and said, that's it. As long as I deliver shareholder value, I'm doing my job. But that's very problematic. What may deliver shareholder value in the next 1 to 2 years may destroy shareholder value in the next 5 to 10 years, because the organization is a living human community, and its network of relationships with its customers and with its suppliers and all of its, you know, partners, whether they're formal or informal, is what enables it to do what it does. And if I'm focused on delivering shareholder value as this kind of obsessive aim, I may literally be destroying shareholder value. I think that's happening in a lot of companies today. I kind of like the way you framed the question. To me, it held within it a particular perspective for responding, and you used the word balance. You know, you might say in another sense, well, heck, there's nothing different with that CEO than all of us. Every single person living in this crazy world of cross currents today is in some sense saying, well, what does it mean for me to have a ground to stand on? You know, what gives me balance and orientation in my life? I think the biggest tragedy of focusing on a single constituency like the shareholders is it actually diverts people's attention away from what is always a more fundamental question, which is, what's really meaningful for me? When all is said and done, what are the things that I really care about? And ironically, although that might sound selfish in a way, I think it really is the only sane path to a degree of selflessness, because you discover when you really ask what matters deeply to me, that it turns out that a lot of those same things matter to everybody. Carl Rogers once said, what's most personal is most universal. And I think it is the only path to striking a balance between the self and others. So that's one of the challenges, and it's increasingly hard. I think one of the people we don't feel sorry for enough today, one of the groups we don't feel sorry enough for today is CEOs, people at the heads of organizations, school superintendents, school principals, state heads of whatever. We think they're all powerful in a position where they're getting all this gratification of ego and desire. They get money, they get power, they get visibility. In fact, 9 times out of 10, they're very lonely. And the best of them are often particularly lonely because they feel like they're swimming against the stream completely.
Brian, do you want to follow up?
Well, I think the second side of that is I think that what people fail to realize is that when we're being judged for what's good or bad and what's driving our factors of change, that typically the people that are judging us come from totally different points of view, that what might be good for the shareholders may not be something that Wall Street values, so that if I'm the CEO and my stock just dropped 60%, believe me, my ability to stick with a change program or what's a good loyalty program for my employee just goes away, because if I don't get that stock up, I'm fired.
Right.
But anyways, I love your books, and keep up your great work, and thanks for allowing the connection to share this with us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Brian, thank you.
Maybe I just add one comment onto that last point that Brian was making. It's very true. It's one of the more powerful arguments for why the isolation is actually the deeper problem. A person in a position like that of high risk, remember he started off by saying the risk-reward balance is kind of nutty now. If they approach that as something they've got to do on their own, they'll go nuts. If anything, it's the most compelling argument there is today that we really always need relationships. If I don't have a group of friends, people that I'm really close with, my ability to remain healthy in any sense in that kind of environment is basically nil.
1-800-423-8255, the change connection with Peter Senge. Jamie is calling from Fairfield, Iowa.
Hi, how are you?
Jamie, good.
Love the show.
Thank you.
Peter, you mentioned in passing schools. I know you do work with schools. My question is how you approach a group. If you find, I'm talking public education, by the way, K-12,
right.
I'm not higher ed.
Mm-hmm.
You approach a group of people who, you know, they pretty much fit your profile, not all of them, but some, of a group that really wants to combine, you know, their own personal learning with collective action of the organization. And they meet, and they organize, and they go to conferences that are relevant, and then they begin to actually move the system forward. And what happens, most clearly seen on school board election night, are 4 or 5 people that nobody ever heard of before in an educational environment run for school board on an anti-everything platform,
right.
And they win.
Right.
And it occurs to me that the school system itself, the CEO down to the classroom teacher, can want to move this thing forward, but to use your term, nobody apparently has more rigid mental models than the community, and what they want their schools to be is what they went to.
Yes.
Now, how do you deal with that?
Well, the first thing is to do the best job we can to kind of see reality as fairly and as objectively as we can and not kid ourselves. It's been my aspiration that a lot of this work would migrate towards being a much more balanced focus between corporations and schools for a long time. But the simple fact of the matter is, I think it's actually harder to do this kind of work in a school. And you really basically illustrated a lot of the reasons, and you got to probably what's the core challenge at the end. A CEO can be terrified of their investors and a backlash that the company's stock price has fallen. But the other side of the coin is the investor doesn't give a darn about how you do what you do as long as you produce a return.
Mm-hmm.
Parents not only want their kids, quote, educated, they want it done in a way that matches their experience. And this is very understandable. I'm not saying this is a criticism of parents. There's a very deep set of what we would call systemic or structural issues embedded in the education system. To me, the only clear implication of that is that any significant effort at fundamental change in education, and this would be true for private or public, has to engage the whole community. It has to engage parents. A lot of times those people come onto the school board with their anti-everything agenda because they're deeply upset. And why are they deeply upset? Because they see a lot of things happening of which they had no say, they had no part, and they're terrified of what could happen to their kids or some other kids. Their motivations are not that bad, but they're very reactive in their strategy. And that reactiveness then in turn creates a ton of problems for the people in the school. But I would say the source of those problems in turn go back to our focus on an ability to engage people at all levels. It's not easy. Believe me, in saying this, I'm very mindful of how difficult it is for a teacher to really reach out and engage parents. A lot of parents aren't available. They're not there. There is no parent.
But Jeremy's point is also that not just parents, the community that votes is not substantially not parents, especially in public elections.
Right.
He's saying that the community is the reactionary problem, is the enemy of change.
Well, it is. Let's say it this way, to try to again be kind of as fair in assessing this as possible. Rather than calling it the enemy or resistive, say the community has its own set of concerns. About 7 or 8 years ago, one of the most interesting change journeys I was involved with was a middle school in Arizona. And over a period of quite a few years, undertook and achieved extraordinary changes in the curriculum.
Save the punchline. We'll come back to it after the break. We're talking with Peter Senge of The Fifth Discipline and now The Dance of Change. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Our guest, Peter Senge, is the author of The Fifth Discipline, 10 years ago, which begat The Fifth Discipline field book, and now a new book called The Dance of Change. His field is the building of organizations. He's the father of what became the Learning Organization. 1-800-423-8255 is the Connection phone, or 1-800-423-TALK. Does your organization, does your institution have a learning disability, Connection listeners? Finish the story about the middle school out west.
Well, it was just
undergoing change.
It was just to illustrate the importance of the community engagement. And this school, which achieved a lot over quite a few years, in many ways, one of the key groups that helped in the process that garnered resources for this school was a group of retired people in their 60s. There was a woman who actually began organizing retirees who was like 72. And she just basically went around door to door and said, you know, we think something really exciting is trying to happen in this school. We ought to all get behind it. And before you know, they had a big door-to-door canvassing going on. Eventually, they built a new high school because they raised funds to public support for a bond initiative. And it was a wonderful example of the leadership that can come from communities. And interestingly, a lot of people say, well, you know, if you don't have kids, you don't care about schools. I don't think that's true. I think one thing that's in us biologically is we all care about kids.
Yeah, well, you know, there's so many inspirational stories about what innovators can do in schools. In East Harlem in New York, I mean, it started 15, 20 years ago, and it's been the model for a lot of folk, and yet that whole school district had to be detached from the school department and exempted from the union before anything could happen. Right. There are fabulous things going on in pilot and charter schools around the country to cope with the new world, and yet there's a equally, multiply more fabulous resistance on the part of the unions and the bureaucracies. What's to help? I mean, I think that's what Jamie's concerned about.
Well, what you're describing is the whole focus of the Dance of Change book, which is this field book with lots and lots of stories. And the genesis of all of this was two things. One is that significant change always starts in small pockets. You know, I'm not a big fan of programs and, you know, things rolled out from the top simply because I've never seen them make any real difference. I've never seen any substitute for small groups of people who get together and say, why don't we do this? And then they start doing it. However, inevitably, those small pockets or pilot groups, whatever you want to call it, the innovators, will eventually bump up against the mainstream. They'll bump against the larger organization, the larger political mainstream. Rarely do they give much thought to what's then going to happen. Very often, the seeds of their ultimate demise are sown in their own bad relationships with those people they're in opposition to. So how we begin to think about this kind of dual movement of nurturing the innovators and simultaneously including, and that's why I said what I did, there's no choice but to include people, including people and breaking down the boundaries and not making it a new holy war with the washed and the unwashed, which is what happens time and again in a lot of the most significant innovations in schools and elsewhere.
1-800-423-8255. The Change Connection with Peter Senge. Dina is on the line.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Dina.
I'm so glad you're doing the show. I think this is a fantastic subject. And I'm sent back to a class I was in at Harvard Business School on managing change in spring of 1996, where you came into the class and kind of did a class for us. And what struck me is how you immediately transformed the class into, brought it kind of like to a higher zone of honesty and listening that I had not seen in the class prior to your arrival. So
wow.
I was completely enthralled.
You're a new person.
And became an immediate fan. So it made me think about how change management or change itself is treated in the business school context. And it leads me to ask even perhaps a bigger question, which is, what are the goals and values of business in the sense that oftentimes, the emphasis seems to be on making money,
right,
rather than what I would hope to see more is providing a service to the community, to society. So if you could talk to that a little bit, how is change or organizational culture dealt with in the business school setting to prepare this right next generation of business leaders for challenges?
Dina, it's a great question, but you got to tell us what you've done in the last 5 years. How did it change you? Did you get happy? Did you get rich?
No, you know what I did? I'm back at Harvard School of Public Health working on a doctorate in environmental health.
Ah, interesting.
I said, you know, I need to work on what Peter said earlier, which is the whole issue of, you know, what are we doing to our world?
Hmm.
So it was striking to me.
That's why they call him a change agent.
Sorry?
That's why they call him a change agent.
Well, suffice it to say that it was a good conversation. I appreciate that. I appreciate you sharing that. It's very nice for me to hear that. I do think that the business schools are a big part of the problem. Now, I say that as a member of that kind of institution, so I'm not taking a cheap shot. You know, we're all part of organizations that have strengths and limitations. But I do believe that this idea that the purpose of a company is to maximize its profit is a profoundly limiting concept. And it orients so much of the teaching and so much of the content and substance of a business school education. And naturally, it's part of the attraction process. So a lot of people come in saying, well, the reason I'm going to invest this gazillion dollars for the next 2 years is so I can go off and make gazillion times two after that. And, you know, things go in cycles. I think we're in a very extreme cycle right now where people literally think it's all about money, but, you know, it will not be like that for all, because it's not. You know, it's funny, the notion of company, you know, the very word company, it actually even has use in English, which is not just about business. You know, we use the term a company of men. It actually has its roots in a French term, which literally means the sharing of bread. Compagne. In Swedish, the oldest word for company is näringsliv, which literally translates as nourishment for life.
Hmm.
See, I think we've understood for a very long time that there's something very special when people come together to do work that's meaningful for them. And that's always the lifeblood. And if you do it well and you're in a business, by golly, you better make money. If you don't make money, you don't have the, you can't stay in the game. So that's fine. There's nothing wrong with making money. But to confuse that with being the purpose is a profound confusion. The other thing that I just wanted to just thank you for in saying what you did, because, you know, I don't think I did that. I mean, that's something that happened in the group. You know, Gandhi used to have a saying that has always been a guidestone for me and many others, I think, that we must be the change we seek. You know, words are always weak. You know, it's what we're doing right now, right here, mm-hmm. in how we're being with one another in this moment, that will always be the most powerful indicator of what can happen.
Dina, thank you for the call. 1-800-423-8255. Tim is on the line.
Yes, good morning, Chris.
Morning, Tim.
Another great show.
Thank you.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk with Peter. I'm on a cell phone, so I'm hoping you can hear me okay.
It's fine.
Peter, my question has to do with TQM programs that were so popular back in the 80s in corporations. And
you said TQM?
Yeah, TQM, total quality.
Okay.
Invested a lot of money and resources in trying to initiate change in organizations and bring about good people and good ideas. And ultimately, most of them, or at least the ones that I was a part of, really failed. And I don't know whether it was because there just was not good, solid support at a high level within the company, or you know, maybe the consultants that ran it just really weren't clear on what the objectives were. But I wondered if you could comment on this, because I think a lot of money was spent on it, a lot of consultants got rich over it, and I'm not sure that corporate America or organizations really benefited from these initiatives.
Not to mention reengineering. What happens to these fashionable cycles?
Same old wine, new bottles. The fundamental problem here is not necessarily in the intrinsic merits of the ideas. Oftentimes, ironically, at the heart of a lot of fads are some very good ideas. Toyota has dominated the auto industry for 15 or 20 years. Its market capitalization still vastly exceeds any other auto company in the world, even though it's much, much smaller. And I think I would argue that it's because they deeply internalized some of the principles of total quality management. But you know what? They never called it total quality management, at least not widely, and they never made it a program. It really was a philosophy and a way of life that they kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And in its heart were things like every human being wants to learn, and why the heck can't we design a work setting where every person has that opportunity? The whole notion of continuous improvement really lies in a very simple idea that every person in any job anywhere always has ideas and has tons of internal motivation to do what they're doing better. The question is, what's keeping them from doing that? So you can pick a handful of companies that had where TQM had a huge impact. Then the real question is, so what went on in all the others? And what went on again and again was somebody said, we got to do this. We got to make it a program. We roll it out through the whole organization. And by golly, it better change everybody in the next 3 months or, you know, it's a waste of time. It's kind of like saying, why can't I become a concert violinist in 3 months? You know, none of us would think you could become a concert violinist in 3 months. Why do we think you can transform the way a company works in 3 months? It gets at a deeper set of issues. Our mindset that comes into play is a profoundly mechanical mindset. We think of programs, rollouts, and CEOs who drive things from the top. We have very little appreciation of the real developmental processes that must unfold in a human community. They take time, they require conviction, they require passion, they don't require speeches.
1-800-423-8255. They do require phone calls. 1-800-423-TALK makes the change connection with Peter Sankey. Anil is on the line.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Professor Sankey.
Welcome.
I have a question which I think Professor Sankey kind of touched on, but I have been to, I wouldn't name the institutions, but so-called most reputed of world's institution, four of them in the last 3 years. And if it is about intellectual curiosity, intellectual honesty, and learning what we are discussing today, I'm completely disillusioned with these institutions. Well, they happen to be business schools of the world. And I wonder what Professor Sankey's comment is about. And, you know, the whole question, fundamental question of institutionalizing the learning, I think, as far as I'm concerned, within my limited understanding, and as far as I can speak for myself, my learning didn't occur in these structured programs. And I had no hope ever of, achieving that learning. And whatever I learned was outside the institution, not with my bright peers, how they acted in class, but maybe outside. And that's my, and even the teachers, what I learned from them was not in the class, but what they told me afterwards.
Right.
So I wonder what's his comment on this.
Well, you're touching on one of the biggest reservations I've always had, actually, with using the word learning. Because as soon as you speak the word learning, the image that comes into almost everybody's head is school or schoolroom. And we immediately then connect with all our emotions, the fear, the rigidity, the being passive. For most of us, school is a very passive experience. So first off, I want to, you know, just affirm that I agree entirely with what you said. You know, the learning that occurs to us that matters occurs in our life. It occurs when there's a breakdown. It occurs when there's a crisis. It occurs when something happens with our kids, and somehow we suddenly realize that, my gosh, I'm part of this problem. It's not just her or him. I contributed to this. And it really raises a very interesting question. What does it mean to talk about a learning organization in any event? You know, why even think about institutions? Why not just forget about them? And the reason for that, for not forgetting about them, I think is very simple. The way our world works today is shaped by our institutions. So we can't run away. You know, you and I are not destroying species acting as individuals, but we're destroying species as we act collectively as mediated through our institutions. We're not creating inequity, but as we act collectively, mediated through the global economic institutions, we're creating massive inequity. So we can't turn our back on our institutions. But at the same time, we have to recognize that learning is not something that, in some sense, can even be, quote, institutionalized.
Hmm. Anil, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Ted is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Ted. Welcome.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I have a question which relates to two of the things that have been mentioned. My family business has been a leader in environmental management issues for over a decade here in Boston. And you mentioned two things. First, that people both, at the very beginning, people both seek and resist change. And secondly, Peter, that we're living in a totally unsustainable manner. So my question is, given that we have this critical need to be more efficient and that we can also benefit from that change, you know, health-wise and financially, Why is this new thinking moving so slowly, first of all, given that we have many examples of companies that are doing great things? And what message do you think it'll take to get change more mainstream?
Do you want to put in a tight environmental focus on the question, Ted?
Preferably, since that's the nature of my work and my family's business.
Okay.
But we can also see it as an illustration. I mean, we can see it as an illustration in the following sense, Chris, and that is that here we're looking at something in our world that everybody knows is nuts. I mean, by the time you're 3 or 4 years old, you can tell this is nuts. Everybody knows it's nuts. Why should we buy a car, use a car, and then throw it in a junk pile? And yet, at another level, we see it as inevitable and nothing can ever change. So you see, it really points to a real condition of our current way of living. We pat ourselves in the back a lot about having all this wonderful technology and this extraordinary standard of living, which, by the way, is only for quite a small minority in the world, and all these wonderful things we've accomplished, and we turn around and we live with these incredible inner contradictions. I think the first thing that it will take, you know, I have to say, I feel a little bit like, you know, we need a global, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. We'd first be able to stand up and say, you know what, our world is really screwed up. And you know why? Because we made it that way. It's not anybody's wrong. It's nobody's fault. We can try to blame it on the politicians or the damn, you know, people in companies who are trying to make money and don't care about anything else. But the truth of the matter is we buy their products. We don't squawk. It is the way we have made it. I think it's going to take that kind of fundamental shift. And by the way, I don't think that happens through campaigns or global programs. I think it happens kind of person by person, team by team, group by group. Let me just say one other thing that might be of some help. Everything that grows in nature grows small. It appears very insignificant for a long period of time. It is the way nature grows anything new. If we give up thinking that we got to change things like we change a tire on our car, we might actually be able to look around and say, what new is trying to grow? It also, by the way, can go from being insignificant to dominant in virtually a flicker of an eye. It's the way things grow in nature. We shouldn't be too discouraged. We should just keep at doing whatever we can do, each of us.
1-800-423-8255. Lynn is on the line.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And Mr. Sanghi, very nice to talk to you. I've heard you, and you practice what you preach. It's wonderful when I see you working with groups. I guess my question is sort of kicks up the issue to a higher level. We do live in a global capitalist environment. We're so proud that we've, you know, sort of championed that over all these other alternative systems, socialism and you know, centralized economies and so forth. On the other hand, what it's meant is this kind of a free fall for this imperative for profit maximization and bottom line driven things, and it's exploiting the global marketplace by saying, oh, now we can go and have cheap labor and exploit even more in these countries that don't have some of the protections that we have. It is such a powerful imperative. It's we no longer have community or corporations. Even the CEOs say that they're subservient now to stockholders into the right. To the stock market that's just looking at the best return and who cares what even the company makes. How in the world do we take these humanist values and this incredible imbalance, which I think is ultimately going to lead to the demise of a balanced society and is leading to it, how do we create a force strong enough to counteract this?
Big question, Lynn. Thank you.
Well, I think that we have to start with our own thinking. We kind of tend to look at the world and create a single interpretation. You know, so things are either getting better or they're worse. And if they look like they're getting better, we feel terrible. And if they look like they're getting worse, we feel awful. If they're getting better, great. The fact of the matter is, near as I can tell, you look at the world today, things are getting much worse and things are getting better. They're both happening. It's a period of extraordinary cross currents. I agree completely with what you said. I mean, it's always sobering to travel outside the United States these days. There's a kind of media hype in the U.S. I really believe that's the essence of it, that says this is the greatest of times. Everybody's getting wealthy and da-da-da-da. Boy, I tell you, it doesn't look like that as soon as you travel very far outside this country. Everybody is not getting wealthier. The poor are getting poorer. They're getting more disconnected. And it maybe is too kind of incendiary a word, but it is a very exploitive system. I agree with you completely. And simultaneously, everybody, or lots and lots of people, let me say, are asking the various questions you're asking. I mean, this is not something we're blind to. One thing that our media does create today also is a kind of transparency. Nike is part of a sustainability consortium we've started in Seoul now. Now, it was founded originally by BP and a company called Interface in the U.S. and Ford and Shell. And all these companies are kind of the heart of the industrial age infrastructure, but they realize they have no future. The future of cars is not, you know, 10 miles to the gallon. Everybody knows that. It's probably 200 miles to the gallon. You give the car back to Ford when it's done, they build new cars out of it. And the future of the oil company is not oil. It's energy. And maybe it's conservation. Who knows what it is? It's probably fuel cells. But the interesting thing was, when Nike joined, people had real reservations for reasons that a lot of us would have. But, you know, it's been extremely painful for the people in Nike to go through what they've gone through in the last few years. And why has it happened? Because we also live in a very transparent world today. That what Nike did has been done by industrial tycoons in much worse ways for 100-plus years. But now all of a sudden everybody sees it. And there's no more closed boardroom. You can't go behind those closed doors, slam the door, and say, well, now we'll do whatever we need to do to maximize our gain. So it's a world of extraordinary cross currents. I think many of us have kind of seen from looking over the shoulder of the people at Nike that they realized that they did some things they shouldn't have done. But you know what? They probably did stuff that was no worse than lots of others. The question is, what does it mean to live in this very public world? That's an extraordinarily new question for the corporations today.
Could I ask you a semi-new question and give you about a minute to answer it? You're well known now for saying that the model of business and organization should be nature itself. We should think like biologists and gardeners, not like mechanics. Apply that.
Well, I did a moment ago by saying that we have to keep reminding everything in nature starts small. I mean, I'm actually of the mind sometimes that we should just throw out the word change altogether, because we always use it like, you know, A is changing B. I am changing you. She is trying to change me. The CEO is trying to change us. So it always has this very mechanical, linear kind of feeling. When in fact, if we simply shifted and said, well, wait a second, what new is trying to grow? What are the forces that are supporting its growth? What does it need to nurture it? And what are all the impediments that would keep it from being able to continue to grow? That little shift in our questions would lead us to stop being change agents and actually start thinking, well, it's really just my life when we get down to it. What am I going to do differently today?
Interesting question, Peter Senge. This has been fun. Peter Senge's new book is called The Dance of Change. We had help today from Michael Garth, Nahani Rouse, John Hoder, Tim Monroe, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. Coming up on Here and Now at Noon, in addition to all that's news, Crying Wolf, a small New England college town, is the setting for Peter Abraham's psychological thriller, Crying Wolf.